Welcome to Short Story Today, where we celebrate short stories and the authors who write them. I'm John DeSavino, and I'll be your host. This week, we celebrate Kitchener, Ontario author Dave Gregory. His fiction has appeared in more than 60 publications, including Fictive Dream, Ellipsis Zine, Fire Words, Moon Park Review, Reckon Review, and Emerge Literary Journal. He currently edits fiction for two Los Angeles-based literary journals, Exposition Review and Five South. Today, I'll be reading his story, Last Jump Off the Lift Bridge. But first, here's my interview with Dave, which took place on February 29th of this year. I'd like to welcome Dave Gregory to the podcast. How are you today, Dave?
I am great. Thank you so much for having me. This is quite an honor. Been listening to this podcast for a while, and I'm thrilled to be included.
Oh, I'm thrilled to have you. And I've been aware of you and your writing from fairly early on in the life of this podcast. So I'm excited to have a chance to talk to you today about your stories. But before we do that, I wanted to just kind of establish where you are on the globe. You're in Kitchener, yes. Ontario, right?
Yes, the unfortunately named Kitchener. So it's about an hour from both Niagara Falls and Toronto.
So you're closer to the border where Buffalo probably would be the entry point, right? For most people. Yeah. And I noticed that in some of the stories, you do kind of explore, you know, from a young person's point of view, what that proximity to the United States, how that kind of figured into your life as a young person or your father's life. I think we had talked in an initial conversation about the Colborne stories, which, you know, we're going to get into in a little more detail. Those were actually from a generation removed, right?
Yes, exactly. Those were all stories that my father told to me first. And he grew up in Port Colborne, which is probably only about maybe 25 minutes away from the Peace Bridge at Fort Erie. It goes straight across the Niagara River into Buffalo.
I'm always curious about influences, because I know from conversations I've had with other Canadian writers that American culture has always had a big influence on the lives of Canadians. So that's something, you know, that does come up in a lot of the stories that Canadian writers are writing. So yeah, these are things I want to explore a little further, you know, once we get into the specific stories. But before we do that, I'd like to hear more about your background, because you've been a writer since your early days, from what I gather, but life, as it has a way of doing, intervened, and you ended up working for the cruise ship industry for like 20 odd years. You were writing before you got caught up in all of that, obviously. Start from the beginning of your writing life and then move on from there.
Yeah, my first recollection of being a writer came in about grade three. And I still to this day don't know why she asked me, but my teacher at the time took me aside in the middle of a class and said she wanted me to write her a story. It wasn't to be graded. Nobody else was asked the same thing. She just gave me a topic and she said, write me a story on that. And I never asked why she wanted to do that, but she did. And then 3 years later, at the end of elementary school, we had a little graduation ceremony. And out of everyone in the class, I was the only one to, they didn't give like one to a boy, one to a girl. I was the only one that got the Creative Writing Award. And my teacher gave me a copy of a novel that I guess she had purchased, 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea. And she handed it to me and she said, I got you some Jules Verne to increase your imagination. And I don't know. I didn't really begin writing, though, until my university days, like writing regularly. I didn't really call myself a writer. And it started at university where I had to read a lot, textbooks all the time. And it didn't turn me off of reading. It just made me want to read fiction. And my first summer after first year of university, all I wanted to do was read fiction. Second year, the same thing happened. I just wanted to read fiction, but I also started thinking, you know, I could do this novel thing. So it really started around then, about second year of university, where I started calling myself a writer and I started putting out stories, none of which were really any good. It wasn't until after I graduated that I got a job at the university of all places. I decided I didn't want a career based on what my education was in. I decided I wanted to do something with books, and I ended up working at the university library, but it was just seasonal work. So I was laid off during the summer again. And that first summer, as soon as the contract ended, I just sat down, wrote a novel in 16 days, and 500 or so hours later, I finished editing it and I self-published it. Gave a little reading at the library. I think there's still a couple of copies on the shelf behind me that I haven't read in 25 odd years. And then I joined a writer's group not long after I wrote that novel, and that nearly killed my inspiration for writing because it didn't go very well. We'd be all sitting around a room, and one person would say to another when they were reading her work, like, "Oh, that's such an exquisite metaphor." And they'd come to my work and they'd say, "Maybe you should try journalism," and just things like that. Like, oh my gosh, they hated everything that it seemed like they hated everything I wrote, and they told me that I was writing the same thing over and over. So I had to beat that out of my system. I continued writing for another 3 years or so, and those were the days when I was sending stories off to magazines with a self-addressed stamped envelope, and I'd have to wait for a letter to come back to me to say that it was a no, and I accumulated about 73 rejections before I started thinking this might not work. But it really was a case of just one thing led to another. At the university, the job that I had at the library, it was the late mid to late 90s at this point, and the university was running out of funds and they let all the contract workers go. But they had been paying me quite well from graduation until 97, and I thought, I'm going to go travel. So I stopped writing, went backpacking through Europe, flew to Paris, and then went across the English Channel, then came back and made a big W across the face of Europe until my train pass ran out. And then I went back down south and ended up in Greece, where I got a job at a youth hostel. Was there for 40 days and 40 nights, biblical reference intended. And after that, I went to Istanbul, Turkey, got another job there. And when I got home, I'd moved back in with my parents. You know, here I was, a university graduate. I must have turned 30 while I was in Europe, and I had no job and absolutely no money. And I'm thinking, this is great. But my parents were in Niagara Falls at the time, and I thought, well, put those two jobs at the youth hostel down on a resume, and I got a job in a hotel. And it wasn't long after I started saving money that I thought, I want to keep traveling. And then just this tiny little ad in a newspaper came up and it said cruise ship jobs. And I thought, oh, that's it, get paid to travel. So I studied everything, figured out how to apply for cruise ship jobs. It did take a while, it took me 6 months, but then I got into the cruise industry just in a basic entry level job. It was a lot like working the front desk of a hotel, working in the purser's department on a cruise ship, but I worked my way up a little bit until I got to be the manager of the tour office on the ship. So every time the cruise ship pulls into port, half the passengers, sometimes much more than that, get onto these buses and they go and see all the cool things that each port of call has to offer. And managing the tour office, the tour operators were eager to show me everything the passengers were seeing. So every port of call, after all the passengers got on buses, I'd get into a van with the tour operators. They'd take me to see one thing after another. And it could be anything from going to the Vatican to jumping into a Colombian mud volcano to zip lining through Costa Rica. It could be absolutely anything like that. Then they take me out for lunch and then they bring me back to the ship about the time that our passengers were getting back. So that aspect was a really amazing life, but I wasn't doing any writing on the ship, none whatsoever. And that lasted for about 17 years or so. Well, 17 years exactly, almost, before I thought, you know what? I've got all these experiences now. I knew that writing about the ship wouldn't interest me, but I still knew that I wanted to do some writing. So, around that time, I got back in touch with a woman that I had dated in high school, and she came on one of the cruises. We'd been in touch a little bit over the past 30 years, but it at that point, it had been at least 8 years since I'd even heard a word from her. And she came on the cruise ship and we started talking about getting married. And I thought, that's it. I've got all this money in the bank. I'm going to retire and I'm going to move in to this place here, the apartment where I still am now. So that was in 2017. I left the cruise ship, moved in with my girlfriend at the
Yeah.
time, became my fiance about a month later, and then we got married just a few months after that.
Wow, you got some amazing breaks along the way, obviously, to find yourself in an industry where you get paid to travel.
It really worked. It was a great lifestyle. Being on the ship itself is actually terrible because you work 180 days straight. There are no days off. You put in anywhere from 11 to 13 hours a day. Sometimes it was even more than that, just because I was putting together presentations like slideshows and things, using all the pictures I was taking on tour to sell the tours to the passengers as they came on board. So that's really the only writing I was doing while I was on the ship. But yeah, it did work out quite nicely. And because I had no house or car or children or any expenses, all the money was going into the bank. So when I left the ships in 2017, I retired to this room here to write some short stories, 90 or so short stories since then.
The number is pretty staggering, and we're going to talk about wanting to see these in collections, which is a conversation that we started the first time we spoke. But yeah, just to get back to the cruise ship experience. On your website, you have a section. You have stories kind of broken down into groups, and there's travel stories, which I would imagine your experiences while you were on the cruise ship put things in your mind for possible future story writing. Did you take notes while you were doing stuff out there, or
I thought I would. I bought a journal when I went to my first contract on the ship, but it never worked that way. The job was too intense to be taking any notes. It was just long, long days. When I went backpacking in Europe the first time, I did take a journal then. And that was about almost exactly 6 months that I spent backpacking in Europe. And to this day, I still have written far more stories that were inspired by those 6 months backpacking in Europe than all my 17 years on cruise ships inspired. I still think there's only maybe one story that even mentions somebody that works on a cruise ship, and a few others. There were tours that I had taken, like river rafting on the Martha Brae is almost the title of one of my short stories that was published in Fictive Dream. And that is exactly a tour that I took. And there's another one about getting a helicopter that flies you not onto a glacier, but near a glacier and going hiking there. That's another tour that I had. So there are a few tours that inspired stories, but actually, ship life, I didn't find it interesting. I find writing about it even less interesting. While I was on the ship, I knew that one of the ships, I knew that someone was writing a novel about ship's life, and somehow I got a hold of it, and I thought, this is boring. This is what every day is like. Why would I want to write about this? I did run into quite a few crazy stories that I tried writing about, but there just wasn't the interest in it. Like there was when I was the front desk supervisor, cruise ships, you fly to an airport. The cruise company takes your luggage from collects it from the airport, takes it straight over to the ship because you put these tags on it, and sometimes a bag goes missing. And airlines lose luggage all the time, but the ship gets blamed for it because the ship sails and passengers don't get their luggage. And one woman was all panicked about her luggage. Oh my gosh, I need to get this luggage. I need to get this luggage. But we were sailing to Hawaii from Los Angeles to Hawaii, which is 4 straight sea days. There was no way to get that suitcase on board. And when the port agent actually brought it on board, he said, Dave, I want to talk to you about this suitcase. When we picked it up, it was vibrating. And the woman who owned the suitcase, she was well into her 80s. She was just a gray-haired, small woman, but he had to open up the suitcase to see what was vibrating, and it was all sorts of sex toys and
Oh my
rubber boas and things like that. So there were some interesting stories on the cruise ship, most definitely, but very, very few that I actually wanted to write about. Even though I had some great adventures, most of the time, pretty much, was just sitting at a desk with no window and sending emails and proofreading booking forms and that sort of thing.
it's a kind of courageous choice to make because, you know, the irony is that you're out there in the world seeing all these places, but it's really an isolated existence in many ways, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, I touched on a nerve there. It was very lonely. I mean, there were some people that just came on ships and hooked up, and all kinds of great and wild things were happening. And there was a crew bar on the ship, which is a fair bit, like you saw in Titanic, where Leonardo DiCaprio takes Kate Winslet down and they're all dancing, and that's where all the fun is happening. It really is like that. For a limited number of crew members, they have, a party every single night in the crew bar, but that really wasn't interest for me. It was, for the most part, it was quite lonely when I was going off on all these adventures. Time and time again, I wished I had somebody to share these with, besides one of the different individual tour operators and tour guides that I was going with.
Well, your story had a happy ending when you reconnected with your high school girlfriend, and that turned out to be the love of your life. So, you know, yeah, you've had some real blessings along
Yeah,
the
absolutely.
way there. And now you get to write. So that's what we're going to be talking about. You have all this time to write. So now that you have this freedom to write and the time, how are you approaching your days, you know, in terms of your setup, your routine? Do you have a particular routine that you follow?
Well, it all changed in almost exactly 2 years ago. In 2022, it changed. Up until then, I was just sitting in this room right here, writing stories every single day. I would sit in the chair that's right beside me here, and most days I would be editing stories. My habit is I'm a little bit of a perfectionist, and this is why I've never tried writing a novel since those earlier small scale efforts back in the 90s, is that I'm a bit of a perfectionist. I don't consider a short story done until I've read it through at least three times without making even one single change, not even a comma. As soon as I move a comma or erase a question mark that I discover never should have been there in the first place, I have to read it again three more times without changing anything. And I did count, once or twice, or actually put a notation on the manuscript. And it was around 45, 47 times each that I would read a piece. So out of my days, probably maybe three each month were actually spent writing new stories, and I could usually turn out a story in a day. The other 27 days were, reading manuscripts aloud to myself, slowly making edits, and learning the markets where I could publish and send these stories, because I was quite prolifically sending stories up until 22. There was 1 year I sent 601 submissions.
Wow.
It was something like 25 stories that went out to several different places. I was getting published quite a lot, which was good. So even though I got plenty of rejections in there, as soon as you get one acceptance, that erases every single rejection. I think the most rejected story is 73
Wow.
rejections, something like that, before it got accepted. Now, what happened in 22 is that I was just handed a position. I was given the temporary reins as editor in chief. It was for a year. Of Five South, which is an online literary journal out of Los Angeles. And somebody that I just met, I guess through Twitter, I saw an advertisement for some event that she was having. I went to it and we stayed friends. We corresponded a little bit. And then at one point, she just said, "Hey, Dave, why don't you edit the journal for a year?" So I did that, pretty much brought my writing to a halt. And that was okay. I thought, it's time to do something different after 5 years of just sitting in this chair, reading stories aloud to myself. So I wanted to make that change. And publishing other people's work is just as much of a high to be able to reach out to someone and say, "Yeah, I want to accept this work," is just as thrilling to me as getting an acceptance. And of course, you try and think about the rejections as little as I thought about the rejections I was getting. So that position as editor in chief was only meant to last a year, and it did. After that, I sort of created a job for myself. At the time, we didn't have a long fiction section. By long, I meant anywhere from about 3,000 words to 8,000 words. And I thought, why don't I be a long fiction editor? So I stayed on at Five South in the new position. And just a few months later, I had been a reader, actually an associate editor, with the Exposition Review, which is another online literary journal out of Los Angeles, California, if you can believe it. So I've been with them for 4 years already, mostly just reading and attending the meetings where they consider which pieces they ultimately want to publish. And then I thought, well, the editor-in-chief position was winding down. I thought, why don't I throw my hat in the ring and apply to be a section editor at Exposition Review? And that happened. So now I'm the long fiction editor at Five South, and I'm the fiction co-editor at Exposition Review.
So that's got to be time consuming, but that still, I'm sure, leaves you enough time to do your own writing, I would imagine, right?
There's still plenty of time. Yeah. When I was editor in chief, writing had stopped almost completely. And then when that term was up, somebody else that I had met through Twitter reached out to me and said, you know, Dave, we live 20 minutes apart from each other. Do you want a writer's group? And I've pretty much, all as long as I've been writing, I've been in one writer's group or another, and one that I had been with for the first 5 years or so of my retirement wasn't cutting it for me anymore. And I thought, okay, as soon as this editor-in-chief job dies down, let's get together. So it's just me and one other person. We meet once a month. We usually discuss about two stories at a time. And that's what's been getting me back into writing. So now I've got 16, 17 stories that are still a long way from completion, but I've already had the draft written and some feedback on, so I know what changes I need to make. So at some point, maybe when after the next issue of Exposition Review comes out, because it's just an annual journal. So once that workload dies off, I really hoping I'll dive right back into it and get, you know, 40 submissions off at the same time, you know, send 16 stories to, you know, four or five different places each, and just get back into that, the spreadsheet tracking all of my submissions and rejections and things like that.
Let's get into talking about the stories. The range of stuff that you write about, it's pretty far reaching. But the thing that I'm particularly fascinated with, and so maybe we'll start there, are these Port Colborne stories. These are coming from an oral history from your father's life. So it's a generation removed, because they're set in the late 40s, early 50s, maybe. And they have a very kind of timeless feel to them. What I love about these stories is there's a real working class feel to the lives of these children who have to find their own amusement. And oftentimes that means doing really reckless things that, in this point in time, looking back, just seems like insanity, you know, jumping off of bridges and things. So let's talk about those stories and how, you know, you kind of filtered your father's oral histories into these fictions that you put on the page. What was that process like? How did you gather these stories in order to be able to transform them into these fictions?
Starting around maybe 2005, somewhere in there, my dad just started talking more. At least that's my perception of it. Maybe I just became a better listener. Because when I was growing up, my dad didn't sit around telling stories about what his life was like in Port Colborne in the 50s. But in the early 2000s, and then especially after about 2012, every time I went home, like in between contracts on the ships, I'd be home for a little while. And he always had a story to tell. Actually, even earlier than that, when I came back from Europe, he started telling stories. So even back as like 98 is when I first recall him telling all these stories about him growing up. So that's when I started hearing them. So I was already 30 by that point. And they just came to be more and more every single year. He'd have a new, sometimes funnier story, sometimes a slightly different version of one that he had already told. And as soon as I retired and left the cruise ships, the first time I was home, he started telling me about his hallucinations. And there's just this really sweet story that he told that I had never heard before about a bear. Every single time he woke up in the middle of the night, he'd see a bear in the hallway of the house where he lived. And that bear would take him to the washroom. You know, he'd take a step, the bear would take a step, the bear would look back, make sure he's following him. And I just thought, you know, I'm gonna write that story down. And I talk a little bit about the hallucinations and things like that because it was just an interesting angle. And that's the story that's just being published now, all these years later, in Ellipsis Zine, issue 14. It's available for pre-order right now. But that's a story called The Bear. And that was the first story that I actually wrote about my father. And I thought, okay, so it's been 20 years. I've been trying to come up with a way to record him. And I thought, I'm just going to start writing because that's what I'm doing now that I'm retired. And I discovered quickly what I really liked about it is that I've always been afraid to mention technology in stories because I love that you use the word timeless. That's really quite flattering, but that's what I want the stories to be. I mean, who knows if in 10 years from now anybody even knows what TikTok or Twitter is, because there's technology that I was using not that long ago, MySpace, for example. Nobody even knows what it is. So I was hesitant to mention technology in my stories. And it occurred to me that back in the 50s, there were boats, there were bikes. And this is a little canal side town right on the north shore of Lake Erie. The Welland Canal travels right through it. And there was a phone. People still use phones. The technology is completely different, but people still understand a phone call. They understand riding a bicycle down a hill, playing in a sand pit. Not a lot of people rode a lift bridge up to the top and have a contest to see who could be the last one to jump off of it from the highest point as it's going up. But that's what I liked, is that that technology would never fade from memory. Everyone would be able to open a book and read about a bicycle and have some idea what I'm talking about. The other thing that I really liked is that most of my publications, I'd say probably three quarters, have been accepted by American literary journals. And in Canada, we have Metrick, but Metrick only became our official standard of measure somewhere around 78, 79, somewhere in the mid to late 70s at any rate. So my dad, when he's telling these stories, he is using feet and inches and yards. And I have to go through and change that every time I was submitting to an American journal. So for those two reasons, those stories were just really working for me. And there's one story, $18 shoes that my dad, and it was just about this prank they played on this kid that had expensive, in those days, $18 shoes were expensive shoes, and they played a prank on him. And when my dad told the story, he just thought it was funny that they played this prank, and the kid was so scared to go back and tell his parents that he had lost his $18 shoes, that he was walking down the pier saying Lord's Prayer. My dad just thought it was hilarious, and I sent that to the writers group, and they said, "This character's an asshole. Why would he be so cruel to this kid? He's got to have some redeeming features or something." And I thought, yeah, that's right. And that really set the trend for those stories, because $18 Shoes is one of the earlier stories that I wrote that my dad told me first. My dad would tell the story and I'd transcribe it, but I'd always have to make him a little bit of a more sympathetic character, or I'd have to add some other sub themes and plots and things like that. So there's always a still a creative aspect. They're not, my dad's biographical stories by any means. There's plenty of embellishment. I just did what I thought suited the story and made it the most palatable a story that it could be.
And $18 shoes, one of the things that kind of sets that apart from the other stories is you bring in the socioeconomic differences that create these dynamics between the boys. They all kind of mix because they go to school together, but there's definitely these aspects of class that separate them and cause them to look at each other very differently. And so that all comes into play, those class differences in this story in a big way.
And they featured into my dad's life as well. So usually he would tell a story frequently. It was one that I had heard before, but since I retired, I'd go home for Christmas and Easter and Thanksgiving and that sort of thing. And there'd always be a moment, usually after dinner, where he'd just start telling these stories. So I'd come back, I'd write them, and I very rarely would call up and say, "Dad, what did you mean when you said this?" That very rarely happened. It was usually I'd make a lot of guesses. Then I'd go back and he'd tell the story again, and I'd refine a few things. And then I'd send them to him. He did not read at all, but my mom read the stories to them. And really, what was going on in my mind, writing all these stories about my dad, is that he was quite old at the time. When I retired, he was 79, and I knew he didn't have that long left. And it was important to me to get all his stories down before he passed. And thankfully, I did. I had 16 stories. And not his last Christmas, but maybe two Christmases before he died, I printed all these 16 stories up in a little booklet, handed it to him. He'd read most of them, or been read most of the stories prior to that. But I did have a finished book to present to him one Christmas about 2 years before he passed.
Well, that is a remarkable gift to provide your family with. What you're doing is something that a lot of people talk about, wishing they could do, whose parents, grandparents, have lived difficult lives, come from an immigrant background. There are incredible stories there that are just going to vanish once these people are gone. That's a legacy that you're providing your family. So that's, for me, what I, find so impressive about this and these stories. There are recurring characters in these. Ronnie is in The Last Jump Off the Bridge. He's also in $18 Shoes. Is he your dad in these stories?
My dad is Ronald Gregory. None of the
Okay.
names have been changed in any of those stories. When he
All
was a
right.
kid, he was called Ronnie, and his sister was Bonnie. And
Julie Gerard.
there's a boy called Julie, and there really was. Yeah, not all of them, but most of the minor characters are the same names that my dad used. Frequently change a last name or something like that, just because their families are still around. But the Ronnie in my stories is my dad.
Wow, I just love these, and I know that you did mention that you're hoping to gather these together for an actual, I know you made up that manuscript for your family, but you're hoping to get these into printed form for public consumption at some point,
At
right?
some point, I've tried. I really haven't invested the time and energy to submitting full-length manuscripts that I have. Just for submitting individual stories. Part of the reason for that is just because I'm not sure that anything is ever finished. There was one story that I wrote just before my father passed that he never got to read, but it's another story of those original 16. And I keep thinking, well, what if I remember something else? Or what if I think of, a new angle on a story that he told and I need to change? So I never feel that it's finished. I could probably put together a book of travel stories, but there's going to be more. Something's just going to occur to me at some point. So I always think, the manuscript, the books of the main themes that I write on, I'm never convinced that they're actually finished. So that's why I haven't invested that much time into it. And the other thing is that I'm a Canadian and I do worry about American publishers. Would they take a chance with a Canadian writer? Because a lot of the people that would buy the book without marketing would be Canadians. And there are those shipping costs that might kill the sales for a book. So I do wonder about that sometimes. Having said that, though, I have sent that collection of stories that my dad told me first to a Canadian publisher. I just sent a query letter. They asked for the full manuscript. That was not accepted, unfortunately, but they gave it a serious look. And then there was an American journal that wrote back kindly to say, oh, it was really close, Dave. So maybe some point I will find a publisher for that. But that international boundary is a bit of a barrier just because of shipping costs. Shipping costs is not
And
cheap.
it's a shame because these stories have universal appeal. I mean, any American reader would be able to, identify with the families, the places, the characters in a way that there's nothing foreign at all in feel about these stories.
Excellent. Thank you.
The thing that I think separates these stories in a particular way from some of the other categories that you write in is the element of suspense. These stories, most of them are like so suspenseful, and you really get the reader's heartbeat racing because
Awesome.
there's danger. It's the kind of danger that in most cases is from people choosing to be reckless, right?
Yeah.
So, you know, that kind of adds a edginess to the proceedings. So maybe if you could just speak to writing with that in mind, creating suspense for the reader, and what different muscles does that take than when you're writing something of a more kind of gentle, contemplative nature, like you do in many other stories?
I think more than anything, that idea of playing with tension and ratcheting it up just comes from reading for various literary journals. Because in addition to the two that I'm currently editor or co-editor of, there have been two others in the past that I was just reading for. And it was reading like 1,200 stories a year, which was just an immense amount of stories. And by far, the number one reason why a story was rejected is that there was no tension moving it forward. So when my dad was telling me a story, I'd look for the tension, because that's just what a story is. There has to be some tension moving it forward, keeping the reader interested and turning those pages or scrolling on their phones to get to the end of it. So that's really all it's about, listening to my dad tell these stories, because he really did those crazy things. He was in his mind, he was a champion underwater swimmer. And there's one story that I wrote where he actually proved that by beating the Olympic champion in an underwater swim. But all the tension is just listening to what my dad had to say, the crazy, risky things that he did, and trying to find a way to ratchet it up, because that's the only thing that's going to keep people reading.
Well, you have great skill taking the oral history and then turning it into literature. Not anyone can do that. You know, you have
to. That's a big compliment. Thank you very much.
Yeah. And you really make these things jump off the page, these stories. So thank you. Yeah. They're just enormously entertaining. I'm getting to the place where I always dread getting to, because, you know, we're running out of time and there's so many other things I wanted to get to. But before we go, let's talk a little bit about the fact that you do write what would be considered flash pieces, although you write the longer stories as well. And your flash stories tend to reflect a kind of different sensibility, I notice. They're more interior in nature. The characters are kind of experiencing a moment. Like, just as an example, the one that I really was tickled by was the one about the radicchio.
A recipe for screaming radicchio.
Yes.
Yes.
Yes. Which I, you know, was, it's a startling story, and it's so different in nature from these other stories, in that this poor guy who's been given the job of cleaning the radicchio, which they've never had, I guess, is like a first for them. And he's looking at this radicchio, and it's reminding him of a doll's head in some strange way. And then he goes into this reverie on his memory of dolls as a child and their sinister nature. And then it turns into, like, in his mind, he feels like he's murdering this radicchio head as he's pulling it apart to make the salad. Boy, that could not be more different than some of these other things. That is a moment in a person's life. And it ends, I don't want there to be a spoiler here, but something happens to this guy where he really kind of has a little epiphany of a sort at the end of the story. Tell me a little bit about where the idea for that story came from.
Well, you'll be disappointed to know that it's really quite literal. I was making a salad and my wife said we need to add some radicchio to it to give it some color. So we went out and bought, well, the salad, the radicchio, and I was holding one in my hand. And it's like, this thing is shaped like a skull. And I was, you know, peeling the layers back as I was, you know, rinsed it. And as we're getting it ready for the salad, just peeling back the layers. And I was sure any second I was going to peel back a layer and there were going to be eyes looking out. And yeah, it was, I'm quite thankful that my wife asked me to add radicchio to the salad. It was actually named on the long listed for the Wigleaf Top 50 last year, which was quite unexpected. And I thought, okay, you know, when we're talking about a skull in somebody's hand and pulling the layers back and it's screaming, it's going to be a dark story. And there was actually a journal at the time that specialized in dark stories with injured characters. And I literally tried to cater that story to this journal. They're not the ones that
Yeah.
accepted it. They ultimately rejected it before somebody took it and it got onto the Wigleaf long list. But I just thought, okay, let's go dark. And that the first thing I thought of as, as a guy, I've always viewed dolls as sinister. When I was much younger, I was visiting somebody and I'd stayed in the spare room at her house and she had all her childhood dolls there. And I turned them around, put them under blankets because I was sure I would wake up and there'd be one standing there looking straight at me. But then I, made the character a little bit damaged. He has some back pain, which is kind of a real thing for me, I'm finding out as I get older. But yeah, that was just the idea to go as dark as possible, but it explored a moment, which is what good flash frequently does. There's a moment, there's a scene, you get in, you get out, you don't explain it, you just let some crazy things happen. And I'm definitely inspired or influenced by so many other great flash fiction writers, many of whom that you've interviewed for this podcast. And a lot of them write some weird stuff. They write, I mean, not all, but there are plenty of interior flash fiction stories and plenty of scenes just exploding that moment, looking at the significance, but still keeping an arc to the story. So a lot of the flash really is influenced by so many other flash fiction writers that I've met through Twitter.
This story is a perfect example of the power of brevity and what you can do, with a flash piece, and you can focus it in a way through this one person's very intense moment and turn it into something that blows your mind, the reader's mind, So yeah, I love discovering those kinds of stories. And then I want to just go to one more flash story. We'll go out on this one. It's not really speculative, but there is a speculative aspect to it. We're all in this sandbox together, which is hilarious. It's like an elementary school playground where children are playing outside during recess, and one child has lost his shoe. It's been buried in the sandbox, and he can't find it. And so he becomes sort of the butt of a joke. What kind of an idiot buries his shoes in the sandbox? And the narrator of the story, it's a first-person narrative, begins at the behest of one of the teachers to help him look for his shoe. These teachers start to get involved. They come over because he's carrying on like he's lost his dog or something. And what happens is more and more shoes become unearthed, none of them being this boy's shoe. This has another real kind of stinger ending to it, which I found so charming and hilarious. So, yeah, maybe just give us a little bit of background on this story before we go.
Okay, I'm also glad you picked that one because that one is highly nominated as well. That was nominated for both a Pushcart and a Best of the Net. Orange Blossom Review published it and
Understand. Understandably, yeah.
gave it those two nominations. That is a real story. I did ask when it was first published if anyone could spot the point where I jump over to the other side, and it's when he comes back the next day. But that first day is 100% a memory of how that went down in a tiny little place called Wainfleet, which for you geographers is about 15 minutes west of Port Colborne. So that's the town where I grew up in, just slightly west of where my dad grew up. And there's this tiny little school, St. Elizabeth, which I just learned a couple of weeks ago. They're going to tear it down and build a newer, bigger school in behind it, which I'm a little bit sad about, but I'm glad I preserved it in this, or helped preserve it in this little story. But there was a kid, and do I call him Matthew in the story? I think I do, but the real kid was Matthew. And
Yes, you do call him Matthew.
after 48, close to 50 years, I could still remember this kid in the sandbox screaming that he couldn't find his shoe. And he was very much the way I described in that story. And everyone was treating him the same way, like, you're an idiot. But then when I thought, specifically to turn this into a flash, well, what's the message? What's the real story? And it's right in the title. We're all in the sandbox together. Everyone does idiotic things at some point, and there's always people standing there laughing at us. But it's like you live in a glass house, don't throw stones, because we could all have lost our shoe in that sandbox. Talking about the metaphor here, we all could have done something just as stupid as this Matthew character did. So don't be mean about it, be a little more sympathetic. But that's what that story is all about. I had a memory that I couldn't get out of my head after 50 years. And then I took what I had learned from all the great flash fiction writers that I've read on Twitter and from reading stories like that. It's like, okay, how do I elevate this? How do I make it a metaphor? Let's explore this moment and let's see what point we can get to. And it was just exactly that. We're all in the sandbox together. Let's be kind. Let's help each other find the shoes that they've lost in the sandbox.
You managed to pack more surprises into that one flash piece than I've ever read in any flash story. It's like they just keep piling up, and it's like whoa, one just trumps the other. It's hilarious. It's a great story.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for taking time out of your day today, Dave, and joining me here. I really
It's been my
appreciate that.
pleasure. Thank you so much.
To find more information about Dave and links to his stories, visit his website, CortlandAvenue.wordpress.com. And now we'll move on to today's story, Last Jump Off the Lift Bridge, which was first published in Type House magazine. So here it is, Last Jump Off the Lift Bridge by Dave Gregory. The lift bridge was the center of town, tallest thing on Port Colborne's busiest street. We started running the moment that mechanical arm came down, halting traffic. Ducking beneath it, we lined up along the bridge's south sidewalk, watching a distant cargo ship glide toward us. 12 of us felt the lurch, our knees buckled as a 150-foot-long section of road rose on counterweights and pulleys between steel towers on opposite sides of the canal. Last one to jump won the game. The starting point was a dozen feet above water. Some dove right away, but the thrill was watching the murky blue-green waterway shrink beyond our toes as we climbed, then looking left and right to see who was still standing. In 20 seconds we were higher than the nearest rooftops. From that height we didn't dive, but cannonballed or leapt with windmilling arms. It came down to me and a kid named Johnny Ridgway. His family raised goats off West Side Road. I usually won, but he tricked me. He was ready to leap, so I backed up, measuring my steps. Swinging both arms upward, he lifted one foot, so I started to run. Then he crouched, like he'd gone off. But he hadn't. He kneeled at the edge, too late for me to stop. Tumbling in midair, I caught a glimpse of Johnny laughing. That sneak! He stepped off, barely a second later, 5 stories up. I jumped from 6 once. I could have beat him. I landed farther out, but heard Johnny's splash and watched a tube of bubbles follow him down like a parachute, opening too late. A dark spot appeared in the center, probably his head. Then a foot twisted below the bubbles as he pivoted toward the island. At least I could beat him there. I was the best underwater swimmer. Passing him easily, I followed the current inland, beneath the train bridge, lifting in tandem with ours. Coming up for air, I made sure the ship was still far off, then swam the last few strokes to where the waterway splits. One side carried fast-moving water through the weir, which we knew to stay away from. The other side led to Lock 8, where the ship was headed. The island was between those two channels. I got there first. I always did, no matter who jumped before me. Climbing the slope, I looked back for Johnny, still mad I'd been tricked. "I don't see Ridgway," I said after a few others caught up. We stared at the water, naming each head as we counted. Only Ridgway was missing. It got tense all of a sudden. Julie and I turned right, scanning the length of the weir. "He's not dumb enough to get caught in there," Julie said. "He's climbed out already. Bet he's back on Clarence Street laughing at us right now." Iron safety ladders hung every 100 yards, but they got too hot to climb on a sunny day. Rust would turn your wet hands orange. "What if he got hurt and is floating near the bridge?" Monty asked. "He'd still float this way," said a kid named Sonny, 1 grade behind me but 3 inches taller. He was already taller than his dad, who worked at the shoe factory. "Ships look out for canal rats. If anyone on the freighter spots him, we'll hear the horn." Julie said that. A canal rat was what they called any kid who swam in the Welland Ship Canal. Sonny piped up, "But I don't see him." floating, swimming, or anywhere. Maybe we should tell someone. Danger meant nothing to small-town kids looking for fun. If my mother knew half the stuff we did, she would have grounded me till my wedding day. The previous year, my best friend, Julie, Jules Gerard, took me out in his canoe. I remember the date, October 15, 1954. Hurricane Hazel should have lost strength and blown south of us. That's what the forecast said. Instead, it shifted and gained steam over Lake Erie. It happened fast. One second it's sunny and calm, next we're riding waves, wondering if we'll make it. I bailed rainwater with my bare hands, while Julie paddled toward the giant grain mills jutting out over the lake, barely visible through gray, heavy rain. "It's hopeless," Julie shouted above the storm. "I'm steering for the islands. We can flip the canoe for shelter and wait it out." They were more like rock piles, three little mounds near the breakwater, but we couldn't find them. "The waves are rolling over the islands," Julie was hollering. I could tell he was scared, something he never was in the canoe. "We should be right on top, but they're just not here. We gotta head for shore." Somehow, Julie steered us to the canal. Waves rolled straight down the center and spilled over high concrete walls on each side. I thought we could ride a wave onto the pier, but Julie didn't want to try. "If we miss by an inch, we'll tip and get dumped in the canal." That's when he saw it. "Ronnie, look!" Julie pointed to a big red fire truck backing to the edge. Waves were broadsiding it. Knowing where the wind would push us, the fire crew spun the ladder over the water. Two men were on it, each dangling a rope. Next, we spotted Julie's mum in her yellow raincoat. She'd called the fire department, worried sick. She stood 20 feet from the engine. I couldn't tell if the firemen were holding her up or holding her back. From the bow, I turned to Julie. "Hope your grip is good." "I don't want to lose the boat." Julie weighed his options. "Waves can't go inland forever. They gotta taper off sometime. I ain't sticking around to find out." The wave crested at the right moment. We grabbed the ropes and hung for dear life. Soon as we looked down, the boat was gone and we were 10 feet in the air. A second later, another wave rose and we lifted our knees to escape it. Firemen grabbed our belts and we felt the engine lurch forward until we were over pavement. 100 yards farther down, another fireman with a long pole hooked the canoe and hauled it in when a wave brought it up. The paddles got away, but we found them floating in Lock 8 with plenty other debris 2 days later. You should have seen Julie's mum hug him when it was over, crying, shouting. She thought he was a goner. But we were fine, wet as everyone else on the pier, but everything worked out. Always did. That's exactly what I was thinking, waiting for Johnny Ridgway to surface. We jumped off that bridge 100 times, and it was never anything but fun. No reason this time should be any different. Another time we cheated death was ice fishing, 2 miles out in a hut made of old doors and corrugated tin. Dozens like it littered the ice. It belonged to someone's dad who worked afternoons at the nickel plant, who loaned us his gear. We sat around an 18-inch hole, drilled through a foot of ice with an auger. We brought lunches and comic books and stayed there for hours, chipping away whatever new ice formed, catching nothing, hoping to snare yellow perch for dinner. Julie noticed a problem. "There's another layer of ice beneath us." Peering through that tiny window into the murky underworld, it looked like a second sheet of ice moving in 2 feet down. I shook my head, then realized what was happening. Julie read the panic in my eyes. "The ice is shifting," I told him, and started reeling in my line. Julie did the same, but didn't understand. I tried to explain, wishing I could show him from high above. "Our sheet of ice is rolling over a thinner one. They get thinner closer to the lake's center." He still didn't get it. "We're on an iceberg, drifting." That time, it registered. Julie opened the ramshackle door to find an endless landscape of snow-covered ice, everything pure white. 30 fishing huts had surrounded us that morning, but each one was gone. Julie and I looked at each other. "We've been abandoned," he said. "Maybe we fell asleep. I can't believe no one warned us before going." We grabbed our stuff and bolted. Carrying everything, we ran for the grain mills at the entrance to the canal. They were the only visible objects on the horizon until Julie spotted more ice huts. "If they're still here, we must be okay." But I told him, "There's a channel between us and them. We're on the wrong side of it." In another quarter mile, we found a 20-foot gash of open water. "What now?" Julie asked, dropping everything. I looked in both directions. This ice didn't break off all at once. It tore open. One end must be narrower. We'll find that end and jump for it. Which way? I pointed toward Buffalo. The lake narrowed in that direction. I guess the ice broke at its widest point, which would have been Port Maitland way. Leaving our gear, we ran and just kept running. Luckily, the gap grew narrower, but it went on forever. It was a long time before Julie panted, "I think I can jump from here. You better be right." We ran another 100 feet, measured our steps backing up, then ran straight for open water. We leapt and stretched our arms like diving for home plate. The shorn edge was thick enough to hold our weight. Only our feet and legs got wet when we landed. Our toes were freezing when we got home, but no frostbite. We caught heck for losing the hut and equipment, which the ice floe never brought back. When the steamship glided under the bridge, there was still no sign of Johnny Ridgway. 11 boys, wet and dripping, stood in a row, praying he'd come up and, at the same time, doubting he was down there. Maybe his brother came and got him, or he left for baseball practice. Until then, no one ever got hurt. Seemed like, anyway. Then I remembered Sonny Dietz splitting his head open 3 summers earlier, playing Follow the Leader, another game we played every day. The leader did crazier and crazier things while everyone tried keeping up. We'd sprint over 50-foot sandhills near the train depot and jump down the side where a steam shovel dug part of the mound away, creating a 15-foot cliff. Or we'd cross the train bridge, hanging from wooden railway ties. When I was leading, I ran down the steps at Third Ferry. The lower platform was underwater. I dove over it into the canal. If anyone landed too soon, they'd scrape themselves on concrete. Sonny Dietz was behind me. Tall kid, he should have had no problem, but this was the most crowded place on the canal. Someone left a bar of soap on the step. Leaning in for the dive, Sonny's toes found it. He landed headfirst on the platform in water 2 inches deep and skidded into the canal. Everyone stopped dead behind him. I heard him scream and felt the bump when his skull hit concrete. I turned and saw an awful gash above his right eye, like a new mouth opening. He wailed in pain. The water turned red before we lifted him out. An ambulance eventually came. He was all right in the end, stayed in hospital a night or two, but was following the leader a week later. He went on to open a hardware store in Humberstone. I don't think he's still around, but he made out okay. Lived till at least 70. But Johnny Ridgway was another story. Waiting on the island in the middle of town, we kept looking. Some ran to the bridge to see whether he climbed out. Others walked the length of the weir, but I stayed put. The bridge started coming down as the massive steamer approached Lock 8. As it glided past, we expected to see Johnny on deck, waving. Once it was gone, we thought his body might surface in the freighter's wake. I was no longer sore Johnny tricked me. I even forgave the time years earlier when he brought a baby goat to school during show and tell. He knew I already had permission to bring my dog Dandy. Everyone had a dog, but no one ever saw a tiny goat. Dandy could have eaten that smelly thing for breakfast. When the cops arrived, they didn't believe anything was wrong. Everything looked so calm on that September Sunday. They asked a few questions, then radioed the dispatcher, who phoned Johnny's mother to make sure he wasn't at home. Told her not to panic, but what mother wouldn't? 5 minutes later, she was running along the far wall of the canal. 2 cops tried to settle her down. That's when we knew. But we always knew. We knew the minute we counted 11 heads coming out of the water. Only one place he could have been. The police knew it, too. Johnny was in the weir, caught against the intake valve. I told the cops I'd dive down and get him, but they laughed and said they'd have to pull 2 boys out instead of one. Maybe with ropes or something you can hang on to me. I spoke to Frederick Nicholson, my dad's friend on the police force. He thought it was a dumb idea. Unless we're wrong and he's playing some lousy game, it's going to take a professional diver from Toronto to get him, using compressed air and steel cables. Removing his cap and sweeping back his hair, Frederick's eyes followed Johnny's hysterical mother on the other side of the canal. I should have chased you kids off that bridge long ago. I'd have hated him for trying, but guessed he'd never have to, not now. The next afternoon, a diver pulled Johnny from the exact spot we predicted. We were in school, behaving. None of us saw him. Port Colborne was different after that. The mood changed. Rules changed. Railings went up. Danger signs caught our attention for the first time, though they'd always been there, From then on, they reminded us of Johnny Ridgway and of everything we lost. Thank you, Dave, for allowing us to read that thrilling and poignant story. Well, that's the end of the episode. Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed it. Please join us next week when our guest author will be Andrea Bishop. The music you hear at the beginning of each episode is by C.S. Fuqua, and the closing music is by Matt Hawkins. You can find out more about their music from a link on our homepage at shortstorytoday.com. You've been listening to Short Story Today, where we celebrate short stories and the authors who write them. Across the bridge of stories, I'll find